Joan Harms I Mukkula Hoiste. I think we better start a bit back. In the thing from your unpublished book which will be published, I gather, in October,
yeah,
which you read to us last evening, you said that Europe isn't a center of civilization. Now I gather from your earlier books that still, if you don't think this, you had to go to Paris to find yourself.
Yes, I had to go to Paris, as I said, you know, to discover that I was an American, whatever that may mean, but I discovered something about what it meant. And because in Paris, I was very poor and scared and all that, you know, but I was left alone. And whatever happened to me in Paris, it happened to me because it was me, and not simply because I was black. It's a terrible sentence to be always, to have interposed between yourself and yourself, this abstraction, which is the color of your skin, what it does in the minds of other people. And the reason I speak of Europe as not being the center of civilization is because of my American experience, which, as someone said, you know, once to me, if you want to find out what's happening in the house, ask the maid. And in the American Republic, I'm the maid. I serve the brandy, I serve the cigars, and I change the diapers, and I raise the children. No one ever talks to the maid, but the maid sees everything. And what I did discover then, you know, was that the morality, which these people accused me of not living by, they didn't live by either. My choice then was to live by my own morality and trust the things I knew and the people with whom I had grown up. And to decide, and this is a very important decision, that between an abortion and a legitimate baby, I will always take the baby and raise it to be a man. It seems to me it's criminal, it's uncivilized to do what so many white Americans do and what the European civilization mainly does, which is to do one thing and say another. To lie about what you do is worse than the things you do. It means that it means you can't learn from what you do.
Yeah.
You know?
But it must have been terribly difficult for you anyhow to go back, I mean to decide to go.
To go back to America? Yes, it was, and well, I think I knew I had to go back quite some time before I did go back. And the reason I had to go back finally, of course life being what it is, a great many things, you know, great many elements come together to force your hand and make you go away if you go. But I'd been in France for a long time by this time. I went home in 57. I'd lived there since 48. And I lived, since I was so poor, I lived with Africans and Algerians, mainly Algerians. And I was as unprotected in a way as they were. I was slightly more protected because I had a green passport, but you know, I wasn't always asked for it in time. And in any case, I could see, I understood some things about the Algerian battle with the French. I don't mean to pretend that I understood what it meant to be an Algerian, but I understood the principle. And everyone I knew, therefore, in France, in Paris, the people I was closest to, were all in one way or another beleaguered and were paying in their own person, you know, a certain price for their society or the transformation of that society. So it seemed to me immoral on my part to live there off their effort and effect, you know. And I couldn't, I just got weary of trying to explain to Frenchmen anything about Little Rock. So I went home and went to Little Rock.
Well, did you feel any kind of affinity with the Africans you met in Paris?
I didn't. Now I feel very differently. I mean, since then I've been to Africa, and I'm a little older than I was. But the great shock, well, the first shock was a very simple shock. And it's that in America, you know, I'm very dark. But I'm not as dark as an African. And it never, you know, it simply never occurred to me before. Though why it hadn't, I don't know. But it simply not occurred to me before that I was really a Métis, just even physically, that I really did not know what blood flowed in my veins, you know. I know most of it is African, but some of it must be Indian, some of it is white.
And where do you really belong? Do you know where you really belong?
I think you decide where you belong. It's an arbitrary thing. I know where I don't belong, you know. I belong at the moment in America because I have a certain usefulness there, or I have a certain obsession. Anyway, I cannot, at this moment in my life anyway, leave that country or turn my back on it. Otherwise, I might belong in Africa. I think I could. I would love to go to Africa to teach.
But you've got a task in America. I mean,
people... I have a responsibility. Yes. And I think the one can't... You may fail, but you can't run away from it.
In one of your books, you're talking about Richard Wright.
Yes.
And you're talking about your meeting him and the clash of generations because your development was so rapid. What will you do one day when you feel the way he did?
Oh, when that day comes to me, and it may have come already, really, I don't know. I think that, to tell you the truth, it's something which frightens me so much that I tend not to think about it, because when the day comes, what can I do? I don't think I'll feel the way Richard felt, but I do think that time being what it is, especially in this century, one can very easily wake up one morning and discover that your work is irrelevant, you know, and that you yourself have already become obsolete. Well, if that happens, I don't know what I'll do. I'll probably take to drink, or... I don't think, I must say, though, that will happen, because in quite that way, I started out to do something very different than what I seem to be doing. You know, I just wanted to write, and hope to live to be very old. And just sit down and write, you know, and not be a celebrity and not be all these other things. And maybe I'll end up, you know, the way I started.
Do you think that this being a celebrity and really doing practical things for your people to help America to reach freedom and love, do you think that it has hindered your novel writing?
Well, I can only answer that by saying I'm still writing novels. It certainly has not simplified my life, but on the other hand, I certainly can't complain about it, because one thing I think is this. You can learn from anything that happens to you. Anything that happens to you, I think one's got to assume, happened to you so you could learn from it. You know, I didn't see this coming. I certainly didn't want it. But here it is. So... I have to survive it. And as of this moment, you know, I am still a writer. I mean, I'm still
yes.
a writer.
Yes. Well, then, to go to quite other things, you've written one of the very best essays on Ingmar Bergman I've ever read. And there you talk about his approach to religion, and you say that you have in some ways the same starting point. And in your novels, which we hear like very much, they've really been a great joy and something different to very many of the young people here in Finland. You sort of have a religious starting point, yeah. And you're obsessed by the Christian religion in the same way as you repel it very very strongly.
Yes.
Could you?
I'm not sure I can be very coherent about that. I know what you're saying. When I met Bergman, for example, and watched his work, and I don't really know the man, but you know, we spent a little time together, and we liked each other very much. And in his personality, in some ways even more than in his work, I felt a kind of kinship, the same stresses and strains, you know, the same faults in the sense of the earth having a fault, you know, the same obsession, really. Which is very strange, since he comes from the north of the world and I come from the south. And yet he reminded me of my father, who was a Puritan, and he reminded me of myself, because I'm also, and always will be, a kind of Puritan. I have, then one of the things this Puritan does is set impossible standards for himself. The trick is not to set them for others. And it was something like this tension in him, you know, which began to illuminate a similar tension in myself. And it was a very helpful meeting for me, because it allowed me to begin to accept this, you know. And the reason that I'm so involved with Christianity and repel it so strongly is because I certainly can't help the frame, you know, of my conscience. And on the other hand, I refuse to accept the cruelty to which this almost inevitably leads, you know, unless you learn humility.
But, and still, in many, very many of your books, you talk about people who fall, people who have to. I mean, it seems to be inevitable in your books that they have to fall very low.
Well, I've seen a great many people fall, and I myself have fallen very low. And sometimes you don't get up. But if you do fall so low and do get up, then you know something which I think you cannot learn in any other way. You look at other people, everybody in the world, in the light of that particular journey, and you understand that what has happened to you can happen to them, and above all, you understand that what has happened to them can happen to you, that you have not the right to judge a living soul. You don't know that man's journey. You don't know where it began, where he is, or where he's going.
And then another thing which really relates to this, I've been trying to sort of, when I came here and found out that everybody was asking your questions, I tried to reread your books. And in relation to this theme of this seminar, good and evil in literature, and then I thought, and I don't know, I might be quite wrong, that you're not really concerned with good and evil. You're concerned with corruption and love and the different sides of love and the fear of loving other people and how it gives you, when you don't, it gives you a conscience that you have to live with because you can't do the good things because you don't dare to.
Yes, something like that. Something like that. Good and evil. Good and evil, my God, you know, it's a coin with two sides, you know. Sometimes good is evil, and sometimes evil is good. You know, you can be doing tremendous things, you think, and have the most terrible evil effects, or vice versa. No one knows enough, really, to know what good and evil are, according to me, you know. That's why that tree was called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which is a very different thing, you know. But corruption, I watched a lot of that, and occurs in many, 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 many ways. And the corruption is always, as a end result, and maybe its starting point, the lack of love, you know. The lack of love, perhaps in the beginning, leading to the inability to love later, or vice versa. I don't know enough about it. But I know that is the worm which eats away the heart and turns people into monsters.
And then still, a last question, really, which doesn't relate to this all. It's in Go and Tell It on the Mountain, when you describe this young girl who falls in love with this young man. And then you say that the first mistake she made was not to get married to him immediately when they went up. Yeah. And then I couldn't really agree. I mean, how can you know?
You can't know. That's part of the terrible irony, you know. And it was only a suggestion. It was what Elizabeth thought herself, that maybe if she had done that at that point, everything would have been saved. We always think that when it's too late to act on it. But according to what Elizabeth knew then, she could not possibly have married him. Do you know? Mm. But nevertheless, she had to live the rest of her life with that terrible suspicion that if she had, maybe he would have lived.
Yes, of course. You know? And then how do you work? I mean, do you live with these people you're writing about? They seem to be so extremely intense, really. I mean, alive.
People I write about?
Yeah.
I don't know how to answer that quite, but the way I know I have to write, you know, the way I knew I had to write Another Country, for example, or anything else, really. I have the people. Somehow something snags your attention, you know, and it won't let you go. I never have a story But I had in another country, Ida, the Negro girl. I had her temperament and her situation and a suspicion of her fate. As in Giovanni's room, I had Giovanni intact. The moment he hit my attention, he was on his way to the guillotine. And then you sort of live with it, you know, day in and day out, year in and year out, and you begin tearing up paper. And the whole effort, for me, is to make the people begin to talk. Now, when they begin to talk, they sometimes amaze you, you know, and frighten you. Ida certainly scared me to death the moment she opened her mouth. And she took the, you know, for a long time took the book entirely out of my hands. But I had to let her go and see where she was going, and then I could sort of, follow after her and sort of tidy up things and pull it together, you know, so that it would look like a book. But in fact, I think what happens is that something snags your attention because it's something you don't remember, which maybe never happened, but something somewhere touched you in that spot before and hit you again, you know, when you're an adult. And then you have to go digging back to where it was in the first place. And when you hit that, then the people begin to move. And then you can hope you've written a book.
Well, thank you. Then I liked Giovanni's room very much. It wasn't... The critics in Europe haven't seemed to like it as much as in America.
It was not...
I suppose that's because people here are very, at least in Finland, very difficult about homosexuality. We haven't really before in our literature.
Well, it was very difficult for me, and it's difficult in America. But the book's not really about homosexuality.
It's so obvious for critics, and in a country like this.
In a country like this, or in a country like mine, or a country like England. But the book is about something else. The book is really about corruption and what happens to you if you don't trust.
Yes.
You know, what you feel. In order to remain moral according to terms that you're not his own, the hero of the book becomes one of the most immoral people in the world. You don't tell life what's going to happen to you. Life tells you. Yes. And you say yes or no to it. Life is not moral. You dig immorality out of life.
Yes, but don't you agree that at one point or another you have to choose? I mean, there's only once you
can
make
a choice. That's right. And David made the wrong choice.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.